It is Thursday, September 26, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice.
The annual Susan G. Komen Pink Ribbon Luncheon will be held Thursday, October 3rd from 11:30 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale. Proceeds from this luncheon and silent auction will benefit Komen Ozark. Tickets and more information available at KomenOzark.org or by calling 750-PINK.
Coming up on this edition of Ozark's new efforts to revitalize historic Cane Hill, we take a boat ride with the University of Arkansas Water Ski Club.
Plus, a look at the 2013 State of Northwest Arkansas report. But first, construction of the 71B flyover in North Fayetteville is moving forward. Over the course of the past month, crews have completed installation of the steel beams that form the underlying support structure of the $6.3 million flyover bridge. Chris Brown, Fayetteville City Engineer, says that the contractor, Emery Sapp & Sons of Columbia, Missouri, has progressed at a pace quicker than originally expected.
Their original schedule that they submitted showed them to be planning to be completed in May of next year, and they are right now a little bit ahead of that schedule even. The weather, as we move into the fall, will start to get more iffy, obviously, so they have to get good weather to continue on this pace. But right now, yes, they certainly are ahead of schedule and have done really well in progressing on the project.
Brown says that moving into autumn, the project can stay ahead of schedule depending on the weather.
Really, what it amounts to is the concrete placement. We can't place concrete in freezing temperatures, and we have to have usually up to about a month of good weather after the concrete is poured so it cures properly. They can protect it and they can do some other things in colder weather, but if we get really cold, extreme temperatures, then they're not going to be able to pour that concrete deck, and that essentially will shut them down until spring. So that's really kind of what we're battling as we move on into the fall and winter months.
The flyover bridge was originally expected to open to traffic in June of 2014. But Brown says if the weather holds out and construction keeps its current pace, the bridge could conceivably open a few months ahead of the contractor's estimated May completion date.
Congressional Republicans have not been able to reach a consensus on how to oppose the Affordable Care Act. Media reports of a heated discussion in the Senate Republican Conference between John Bozeman of Arkansas and Ted Cruz of Texas underscore a growing disagreement in the party over how to tackle the health care legislation. Some in the GOP want to amend the law, while others are willing to defund it, even if that means shutting down the government. Senator Bozeman says action has to be taken to repair the law because he says it's unaffordable.
The problem is, for those of us that oppose Obamacare, the votes simply aren't there in the Senate to actually derail it. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think at the end of the day, it will go back to the House, and then they'll have to decide whether or not to go ahead and pass it as it is or to amend it.
Senator Bozeman says the Affordable Health Care Act is becoming unpopular with the public, and he does oppose it. However, he says he's concerned a government shutdown, as advocated by some in his party, could have a negative impact on Arkansas in a variety of ways.
The military, they would not get paid. People that are dependent on government inspections, you know, things like that, at their factories, they would have to go home. A lot of private business would have to shut down. What does that do to hardworking families, Americans, Arkansans, single moms? Social Security checks would go out, but probably be late.
According to reports at the news site Politico, the normally mild-mannered Senator Bozeman stood up to Senator Cruz and expressed frustration over the tension caused by the congressional standoff over defunding the Affordable Care Act. According to the article, Senator Bozeman told the senator from Texas he, quote, hasn't been bullied since the seventh grade, and he wouldn't be bullied now, end quote.
Next week, work will progress on development of the watershed sanctuary at Lake Keith in Cave Springs. Draining of the lake will begin Monday, during which Delia Hawk, director of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership, says water levels will increase downstream as the lake flows under the Highway 112 bridge.
What the calculations are is that there'll be a slight rise in the water level, but nothing more than, say, we get in a normal rain event. And the reason for that is there's only so much of a hole, you know, that the water can go through underneath the highway over onto the other side. So in some ways it will have its own control mechanism for the size or the amount of water that can go through at any one time.
Once the lake is drained, several development projects at the sanctuary will commence.
Our main focus will be on two outdoor pavilions with restrooms, one on the north side and one on the south side of the lake, a fishing pier, boardwalk, and trails. There'll be a main trail that will go around the lake that will be handicap accessible, and then we'll be also working on some more of the nature trails or primitive trails as well.
While the lake is down, the remnants of a former fish hatchery will be removed. And as a partnership on the project, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission will build educational facilities on the property.
Springville-based Tyson Foods yesterday announced a partnership with the Christian humanitarian organization World Vision to help improve the livelihoods of farmers in Tanzania. The announcement came as part of the poultry giant's participation in this week's Clinton Global Initiative annual meeting. Through the Tyson Foods Fellows Program, Tyson's knowledge about chicken production will combine with World Vision Secure the Future Tanzania initiative to teach thousands of small farmers about best agricultural practices, including basics such as breed selection, water and disease management, best feed choices, and processing, marketing, and transportation techniques.
Van Buren-based USA Truck is facing a second takeover attempt in less than 2 years' time. According to a report by the CityWire, Phoenix-based Knight Transportation this morning went public with a $9 per share bid that was part of a $242 million deal. Knight currently owns 8% of USA Truck shares. The per share bid for USA Truck stock is a 39% premium from the company's share price yesterday. And after the opening bell, share prices surged to around $9 from yesterday's closing price of $6.46.
Clear tonight. Lows will be near 60 in northwest Arkansas, mid-60s for the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow, highs from 84 to 88. Tomorrow night, mostly clear. Lows from 63 to 67. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Yesterday, the 2013 State of Northwest Arkansas report was released. The document was prepared by the Center for Business and Economic Research in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas in collaboration with the Northwest Arkansas Council. Included in the report, the region's employment grew by 3% between 2011 and 2012, but so did the rate of poverty. Kathy Deck is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research and is with us inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome back to Ozarks.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Well, let's talk first about the area that is defined as Northwest Arkansas. It's four counties, three in Arkansas.
Sure. Northwest Arkansas, as we define it, is the metropolitan area. So it includes McDonald County, Missouri, in addition to Washington and Benton and Madison counties here in Arkansas.
I'm just curious, why Madison and not Carroll?
It has to do with commuting patterns. So it's where people work and where people live, and the Census Bureau looks at those kind of patterns and defines a metropolitan area in that way.
So there are far more people who live in, say, Jane and work in Benton County than, say, Eureka.
That's correct. People from Jane come into Benton County all the time, and we don't see enough people moving in the other direction.
You compare us to different peer regions, Omaha, Kansas City, Knoxville, Tulsa, Huntsville, Alabama. How do you choose those?
Well, this is really the art part of economics in terms of choosing who you want to have as your competitor or even peer regions. A lot of these regions are, in fact, much bigger than we are. They have lots larger populations. So some of them we aspire to be similar to. Some of them are nearby, and we just know about them here in this region. So we like to understand, for example, how Kansas City is doing and how we're doing relative to them. Places like Omaha, places like Huntsville have universities. We have a big university. So really, this is just a set of communities that we feel like we would like to benchmark ourselves against.
And it's interesting. Sometimes they're called peer, sometimes competitors.
Peers, aspirants, competitors, anything you want to look at from an economics perspective. In fact, if a site selector is looking at putting a new facility in the United States somewhere, we might be in the running with these regions as well.
I mentioned in the introduction that employment growth was 3% from 2011 to 2012. That's good?
That's wonderful. As a matter of fact, it's about twice. In fact, the national average, it's almost five times as fast as the state grew itself. We don't see anybody else in any of these regions with employment growth that looks anything like what we have experienced here in Northwest Arkansas. So we really are unique in that way.
And this may be elementary, pedestrian, but employment growth of 3% means there are 3% more employed people?
There are 3% more employed people year over year. That's exactly right. So we look on an annual basis for this report.
Where were most of those jobs added?
Well, those jobs were added really across sectors. That's the beautiful thing about this period of growth in Northwest Arkansas. We have seen that growth in one sector builds on growth in another sector. So we see this primarily in the services sector, professional and business services, which we get excited about at the university since we train architects, accountants, and lawyers. That's really great news. We saw a lot of hospitality jobs added, and hospitality jobs are restaurant jobs by and large. You don't have to be crazy about that. We also saw, of course, our biggest sector here in Northwest Arkansas grow substantially. That is the trade, transportation, and utility sector. It includes Walmart. It includes the suppliers. It includes all of our transportation in terms of J.B. Hunt. So when we see that improve, we know that our region is probably doing well.
There's a drop in mining, logging, and construction. Okay, mining and logging.
The way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics aggregates these statistics, they put mining, logging with construction. Obviously, here in Northwest Arkansas, primarily talking about construction.
Okay.
Northwest Arkansas has a cost of living index of 87. What does that mean?
So anybody who lives here in Northwest Arkansas knows what a bargain it is, particularly in terms of housing costs. When you look at other big cities with amenities like ours, you can often find that the housing costs there are just really outsized if you have lived here for any time at all. And so what it is it's a basket of goods. They look and say, okay, how much does gasoline cost? How much do groceries cost? How much does housing cost? And then they compare it to a national average. The national average is 100. In Northwest Arkansas, we're at 87, so we're about 13% less than the national average.
So it costs about 87% of what it would cost on average across coast to coast.
Exactly, okay. To live here. So it really, for what we get, it's a great bargain.
So employment up is good. That 87% cost of living is good. We had the lowest crime rate among our peer groups. We had the lowest cost of living. But then there's that figure that sticks out, 17.7% poverty. That's up, and that's the worst of our peer groups.
Well, that's exactly right. When you look at poverty and associated with poverty income measures and associated with income measures, educational attainment, all of these are places where Northwest Arkansas has some catching up to do with the communities that we want to compare ourselves with. And so it really is a story of, I like to say, bimodal. It scares some people, but thinking that we have a group of folks who are very low on the income spectrum and a group of folks who are very high on the income spectrum, and that middle is a little bit hollow.
So when we look at this big pie, this picture, and we go, okay, we have more jobs, but we have a growing poverty rate, I know the job of the report itself is not to make suggestions or to come to conclusions, but to offer facts. Are there conclusions that others digging into this could come up with?
I think that there are conclusions to come up with. And in fact, it is that if we want to continue to see great growth in terms of employment, we have to continue to invest in the things that we know are important. So what is important? Education. Easy. We can say that over and over. We need to continue to have to increase the number of people who are adults and have a bachelor's degree or higher. We need to work on poverty. We need to make sure that the jobs that we're creating, in fact, are those kind of jobs that you can work full time and not be in poverty once you've worked full time. So we know we have a working poor issue here in Northwest Arkansas. And so I think taking the time to address those issues is critically important. Healthcare, we want to make sure our healthcare outcomes are as good as our neighbors as well. All of these things will help us address it.
And I think that's interesting to point out with the figures, with that employment growth and that high poverty rate, there would be some people who say, oh, poverty, unemployed. That's not the case. That would not add up.
Our unemployment rate is incredibly attractive. Yes, we're slightly higher than we were before the recession began, but from any objective perspective, our unemployment rate is not high here in Northwest Arkansas. So when we look and we see those poverty numbers being high, many of those people in poverty are working poor.
So essentially, we're just not paying our employees enough.
Essentially, we're not paying our employees enough to get out of that category. That's exactly mm-hmm. right.
Well, the report states that home ownership accounts for almost 18% of money spent of your household income. Do we know how many people own their homes versus rent, and does that matter?
We do know about that. And one of the things you have to look at in Northwest Arkansas is we do have a large student population. So sometimes when you look at those rental numbers versus the home ownership numbers, they get a little bit skewed, but they're skewed in a very predictable and easy way to see. So when we look in Northwest Arkansas, by and large, we see home ownership rates between 56 and 66%, depending on what community you're looking in across the area. Renters obviously face a different set of circumstances here in Northwest Arkansas and everywhere else in terms of their characteristics.
The percentage in Northwest Arkansas of people with a bachelor's degree has gone up. It's above the rest of the state, but it still is behind those peer groups and many of the other cities in the region. I know Governor Beebe has talked about this. I've talked to Mike Malone and Kim Davis for the Northwest Arkansas Council. But right, the dots you can connect, the more people you have with the degrees, the more likely you are to attract businesses or companies or employers who want people with degrees.
It is the most striking feature of all these statistics that we have all this prosperity in the region. And in fact, when you look at our educational attainment, we just don't measure up. Now, as you said, there are so many people and so many programs looking to exactly address this problem because we see it as the critical issue into the future. If we're going to continue to have prosperity, we have to have a labor force that is as educated or more educated than our competitors. It's just a fact of life. We are moving in the right direction. This is why we benchmark ourselves not just against the rest of the state, not just against the country, but these neighboring communities as well.
It's about 28% now?
About 28%. I remember when we celebrated when it went over 25%. Mm-hmm. So we are definitely moving in the right direction.
Is it a sea change sort of thing where it will slowly? I mean, you're not going to go from 28 to 35.
Well, you just can't educate people that quickly. Yeah. You can't educate a large enough percentage of the population that quickly. But there are initiatives, for example, Graduate NWA, where they say, okay, there are folks who are just a few credit hours away from getting their degree. Let's make sure that they can – that's low-hanging fruit for us. Let's make sure that they can complete and help us get that percentage where we need it to be.
And probably access to online degrees.
The access to online degrees indeed should help this from our perspective. Keep in mind, however, that all of our surrounding communities have access to online education as well. So we're always going to be trying to catch up with everybody, even though these other communities are making progress as well.
You can't walk, I don't think, you can be an employer and walk into an area and go, oh, Northwest Arkansas feels like it has 7% fewer bachelor's degrees than Omaha. They see the numbers, reports that tell you how many?
That's exactly right. So when you have businesses looking to locate in different communities, they look at profiles of those communities. They go to the same kind of federal statistics that we look at all the time. And in fact, Northwest Arkansas just might get crossed off before we were ever considered because we don't hit that kind of a benchmark. We don't hit that a number that is on par with our peers.
Spending on research and development at the University of Arkansas has increased 8%. According to the report. How does that factor in?
Research and development expenditures, particularly federal research and development expenditures, are one good indication of the vibrancy of a community. And its potential, in fact, to spin off new companies, entrepreneurial-based activity, all of these things happen as a result of those federal research dollars that are invested. Obviously, the university knows this and has been working for some time to improve every year how many federal dollars the researchers there get so that we can have all of these great commercializable ideas that we can put to work for us. So it's again, a trend moving in the right direction. We're not where we'd like to be yet.
Well, this is the third year for this report. Does the cost of producing this report go into that 8%?
Does the cost? Of course, it's not federal dollars. So yeah. Not in this particular case.
Finally, the University of Arkansas, of course, enrollment has grown considerably in the last few years. Until this year, Northwest Arkansas Community College was on a steady rise. UAFS, which isn't in Northwest Arkansas, but John Brown University might be growing with the addition of nursing. Does that help that you have more college students?
There is no doubt that having more college students in our great area means that they're going to want to stay, and the fact that they stay will help us attract great employers and make the region even better. So the university, having John Brown, having Northwest Arkansas Community College, all here to support the business community, I think you can't understate how important it is as a piece of the overall regional culture to have those institutions here to promote promote education.
When you're preparing this, when it's do you make little inside predictions to yourself? Like, oh, I bet we're doing this? Or
well, I do sit there on tenterhooks waiting for the next release. Did we pass 28.5? Did we pass whatever percentage it might be? But it's not so much about a game of predicting. It really is making sure that these statistics that we work so hard to move, that so many organizations in the community work so hard to improve, do keep improving.
Kathy Deck is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. You can find this report online, can you not?
This report is available at our website, which is cber.uark.edu. That's Center for Business and Economic Research.
Kathy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll take your questions about the new healthcare exchanges under Obamacare. Some listeners are wondering, are high deductibles better than high premiums? Who qualifies for a government subsidy? What's better, private plans or public exchanges? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
NPR's Here and Now this afternoon, beginning at 1 on KUAF.
The latest census count claims around 800 people live in Cane Hill, a small town in western Washington County. In the mid-1800s, Cane Hill and Fayetteville, with a current population of over 70,000, were around the same size. Many in the area are familiar with the Cane Hill College Building, or the old metal mill wheel. In addition, many other historic buildings and landmarks are in various stages of disrepair. There have been many mostly unsuccessful efforts to save them, but thanks to an anonymous benefactor, a new foundation has developed, and the 501c3, Historic Cane Hill, has been formed. Many of the buildings and landmarks have been acquired by the organization, and Bobby Brawley, originally from Lincoln and a recent PhD graduate from the University of Tennessee, has been hired to lead these new efforts.
The main thing is they knew that it's going to take somebody local. Cane Hill is a very tight-knit community, and it's important to know that somebody local is going to be looking out for their best interest and taking care of some of these properties down here. And that's really, I think, one of the reasons that historic preservation hasn't been as successful down here as it could be, because they really want somebody that's local to be taking care of their history. And so I was excited to be coming back. I love Knoxville, but the opportunity to come back home was just too good to turn down.
Bobby's background is in anthropology and historic restoration, and today he takes us on a tour of historic Cane Hill.
We're headed south along Arkansas Highway 45, which was really the main street that went through Cane Hill and was originally a dirt road, obviously. In turn of the century photographs, you can see quite a bit of activity starting about right through here with 6 to 8 shops along both sides of the highway, and now these are about the only three that are left, and both of the two of the three are much later.
Cane Hill is focused in an 8 to 9 mile valley along Highway 45, which runs from central Arkansas through Fort Smith and northward onto Fayetteville and beyond. The 16 to 18 nationally registered historic properties are relatively spread out, and the tour we take today is something that Bobby would like to recreate for visitors, as the traditional museum model just won't work here.
I would like to see all of them linked up together with some sort of either driving trail, or my ideal thing would be to see a nice walking, running, biking trail that you could see a lot of these different properties from. After we've done some great historical research, some archaeology, you can generate some nice sign panels, information panels along that trail that describes each of the properties in detail.
Bobby hopes to have markers in place as early as this spring. As he talks, he stands next to the Pyatt Moore mill wheel. Cane Hill was settled in 1827, and many mills were built shortly thereafter to mill flour, corn, and to saw logs. Attached to the rock walls of what is left of a small building, the large metal wheel hangs into Jordan Creek. It is covered in graffiti and very bent out of shape. While this property is owned by a separate nonprofit, Historic Cane Hill hopes to reach out to them and work together to restore what is left.
One of the things the National Register of Historic Places nomination talks about, a lot of the different buildings throughout Cane Hill, they're built sort of in a vernacular architecture, so they're constructed using a lot of native stone. A lot of the sandstone obviously all came from right here. Even when we get up later to the Methodist Manse building, that was made with bricks that were made right here in Cane Hill with locally available clays, and it's one of the only brick buildings at that time that was ever constructed in very early architecture.
Though that brick has been painted over, the irregular shapes from the hands that formed the local clay 179 years ago in 1834 can be seen. The federal style architecture is quite basic and symmetrical. Though the brush has been cleared away, the roof is sagging, and inside, the floor is caving in. Though the town was settled by Presbyterians, there were quite a few Methodists, and this was their church. As the congregation grew, they built a wooden structure, and this became the manse, where the preacher lived.
The most interesting thing about it, and the coolest thing about the association in addition to the architecture, is that this was the Union headquarters during the Civil War. So they used part of it. We know that it was definitely the headquarters. They may have used part of it as a hospital, but they also certainly used one of the buildings up on the college campus for also a Union hospital. So those were some of the only two buildings to survive during the war because they were Union occupied. The Union burned most of the other buildings. So I think this one really has a lot of history.
During the Battle of Cane Hill, most of the buildings in town were burnt down. And the current college building was actually built in 1886. Cane Hill was the first college of higher education in the state of Arkansas, founded in 1834. In 1852, it became the first institution to grant four-year degrees, and in 1875, the first in the state to admit women. The University of Arkansas in Fayetteville became the land-grant institution in the state, and eventually the college became the town's high school and was up and running as such until the town consolidated with Lincoln in 1956.
The building that we're in, by 1858, the college had four buildings, pretty large buildings, which is pretty incredible to think about this little town. But at that time, the population was probably about the same size as Fayetteville. Fayetteville continues to get larger. Cane Hill stays about the same and then eventually starts to decline.
The end of college education in Cane Hill came in 1891. The building is in okay shape, but cracks in the wall along the stairway are clues to structural damage. As with many old schoolhouses, the bell tower on the lawn is a symbol for the town. The bell has been through many iterations, being recast and even stolen for fraternity pranks. As we leave the college and travel north, Bobby takes me by the town's active cemetery on the way to a very unactive cemetery. I was a little concerned as to where we were headed as Bobby turned off the highway and into a pasture, his SUV taking us uphill on property his family actually once owned. The plot has had various names, but is most commonly referred to as the Bing Carnahan Cemetery.
This is one of the few places I've ever seen where it's so early. These folks were actually Revolutionary War veterans, so these two here. And this is John Carnahan and Jacob Pyatt. These are some of the two founding fathers of Cane Hill. And again, you can see why they chose this spot. Amazing, amazing view up here. It's really nice. Got a great breeze. So John Carnahan was born 1756, died in 1840. Jacob Pyatt, born 1780, died 1844. So incredibly early cemetery for this area to have Revolutionary War veterans interred in it. And again, they're some of the founding fathers of Cane Hill.
This property is also owned by the 501c3 Historic Cane Hill. And there are plans to place stone pillars on the corners and a split rail fence around this burial site. Bobby's organization is housed in the 6-bedroom John Edmonston House. Built in 1896, it is also on the list of National Historic Properties. The hope and confidence to restore these properties is evident, and the dream to share the stories of Cane Hill's past is strong. To follow the progress, search Facebook for Historic Cane Hill. This is Ozarks at Large.
And from the restoration of a 19th century community to the revitalization of a mid-century collection of apartments— late this summer, the Urban Land Institute nominated 27 properties in 15 countries for its 35th annual Global Award for Excellence. Of the 27 final nominations, three are in the central United States, two in Chicago, and the eco-modern flat apartments near downtown Fayetteville. The ULI says it picks the nominees and eventual winners based on a high standard of excellence in design, construction, planning, and management. Last year's winners were scattered across the globe, including buildings in Malta, Paris, Ho Chi Minh City, London, Washington, D.C., and Boston. So it seemed like a good idea to go to the Eco-Modern Flats to see how a property in Fayetteville made this year's Urban Land Institute list. Jeremy Hudson, the CEO of Specialized Real Estate Group, opens the door to a vacant apartment at Eco Modern Flats last week.
We came in and we gutted them, removed the bedroom walls, built this media center to divide the unit. So it's it's not exactly a one bedroom, it's not exactly a studio, but it's got this wall that divides things.
There are 96 units at Eco Flats, each 600 square feet and each totally made over from its previous incarnation. The media center Jeremy referred to is worthy of placement in a gothic detective story. Like a revolving bookcase, it swivels around.
Hook up your PlayStation, your computer, whatever. Watch it in the bedroom, flip it around, watch it in the living room. If you're entertaining people and you don't want the TV to be the center, you can flip it around and face the bedroom, and you just got a nice bookshelf in your living room.
The swiveling media center sprang from the mind of Chris Barabeau, the architect for the Eco Modern Flats renovation. He says even though the interiors were completely reimagined, he was able to start with the concrete walls built for the apartment complex in the late 1960s and early 70s. He says the project came with what he calls good bones.
Because of the way they're constructed and originally designed by those architects allowed us to come in and have this kind of second life or second iteration into these bones. And it is a very, it was challenging and fun. Obviously architects love new construction, but I also really love renovation. I think it's great to reinvigorate a place that's been, in the fabric of the city for a long time and make it new again.
Jeremy Hudson agrees the sturdy skeleton was a boon and helped reduce costs compared to many other apartment renovation projects. He says the mid-century minimalist feel also provided a blank canvas to work with that inspired creativity both inside and out. The swimming pool in the courtyard has been redone. It's now heated with solar power, and native drought-resistant grasses surround the courtyard. In between two of the buildings, there are corn stalks growing high, part of a community garden that's been installed. This spring, there were enough service berries harvested to make pies and syrup. Jeremy says the courtyard looks, smells, and feels much different than it did when the property was purchased in 2010. Where the native grasses are now, there had just been an eroding slope of land that lurched toward the building with exposed railroad ties.
And an old concrete pool deck and like a 5-foot-tall wrought iron fence right around it. So basically zero landscaping other than some, turf and weeds. And some old dilapidated salmon-colored brick buildings.
There are vines growing to protect some of the apartments from direct sunlight, and the patio furniture dotted along the walkways and in the courtyard is made out of recycled milk jugs. On top of each of the four apartment buildings are a series of solar panels designed to provide at least 75% of the hot water needed for the 96 apartments.
Basically, the way it works is it circulates a glycol solution through these panels. The sun heats it up, and that solution is pumped through holding tanks and the actual hot water heaters. So the solution heats up the water so that you don't have to use any other fuel. But then there is a natural gas backup. So, in the dead of winter or, cloudy day or late at night, if there's a need and the tanks and the existing supply is not warm enough, then the natural gas will heat it up.
Jeremy says the complex's natural gas bill was nearly $40,000 a year before the renovation and now is well under $12,000 a year. The design team knew they also wanted to change how water was used. Jeremy says while he was in a final examination of the building, before the papers were signed at the closing, he heard water running in the gutters. And this was at the height of summer, weeks since the last major rainfall.
Why is there water in the gutter? And so I found the maintenance guy who is still with us today, a great asset to our team, Glenn. And I said, Glenn, why is there water running down the gutter? And he said, that's because we got the sprinkler running on the roof. And I said, you what? The sprinkler on the roof? And he proceeded to explain to me that for many years, the only way that they could keep the top floor apartments cool in the heat of the summer was to run a sprinkler.
That was literally water going down the drain and figuratively money headed in the same direction.
So we wanted to kind of, in our design of water efficiency, make it a focal point of, okay, not only are we going to have water efficient toilets and fixtures, but we're going to capture our rainwater and reuse it so that all of the landscaping that when you look down here now is this beautiful lush landscaping. Everything is irrigated with rainwater. We don't use any potable water for that.
The rainwater is harvested into a pair of cisterns that look like large tin culverts stuck into the ground. The cisterns look like that because it's exactly what they are. The rippled metallic towers fitting in perfectly with the sleek modern design. The solar power, the on-site recycling, the green roof on top of the management office, and other design features led to Eco Modern Flats receiving LEED Platinum certification, the highest LEED classification there is. Jeremy says the sustainable elements are important and ultimately cost-effective. He says a before and after renovation comparison bears that out. Before, when the complex was about 75% occupancy, utility costs were about double what they are now when the occupancy is almost 100%. That lower cost, he says, is even after the addition of washers and dryers, microwave ovens, increased lighting, and dishwashers to each of the apartments. Residents' utility bills are included in the set monthly rent. Jeremy says there was a reason for taking that approach.
Typically these days, the most utilities are metered separately and the tenant pays for them. So the developer has no real incentive to make anything energy efficient. If his windows are cheap and his HVAC system is not that good and it's poorly insulated, he's not really seeing the financial implications of that because someone else is paying to cool the space. And so that's something that we really look at hard is, okay, let's make ours energy efficient and let's pass that on to our residents, and they enjoy the fact that not only are they paying us one bill, but it's cheaper than what it would be. I think our average electric bill per apartment here averages is about $25 a month.
Most of the 96 apartments lease for an all-inclusive price of just under $800 a month. Sustainable practices can help with the bottom line, and at least for residents Angela Wisely and Johnny Chamberlain, can be a selling point as well.
I worked for an environmental nonprofit for 4 years doing a lot of low-impact development stuff, so I definitely appreciate the stormwater collection and retention features here and the native plant landscaping. I'm a sustainability TA at the university right now, and this is a great place to talk about in that class.
Besides the fact it's beautiful here, there's so many sustainable features that we put a lot of value in, and it just can't help but notice all the community aspects as well. Community garden, the landscaping is fantastic, all native plants, it's gorgeous.
Chris Barabo, the architect for the renovation, says creating a sense of community was a prime objective. The corner apartments have access to private roof patios, and there is one larger community rooftop patio that can be accessed by everybody.
We really wanted to give the community or all the tenants a places to gather, places to meet, instead of just being walk inside, walk in your unit, and lock the door behind you. It was really, really, through design, tried to encourage community interaction. And obviously the people who live here can hopefully speak positively to that, but we've definitely spent time out here just amazed by, and when we're still working at the tail end of the project, just amazed by sort of the buzz of people just moving from apartment to apartment and up and down and around the different walkways. And it's really, I remember a beautiful day being out here, and it's just really invigorating to see the community actually interacting the way we hoped they would.
Chris and Jeremy say an advantage of a complete renovation is the chance to make everything work together. The design team labored over every possible detail, from closet space to the font used on the sign by the swimming pool. Jeremy Hudson says that's really a bit of design heaven.
One of my favorite quotes that I tell my team all the time is Walt Disney. He said, "There is no magic. The magic is in the details." And I think that is so true in architecture and development, that it's those little bitty things of being creative in your design and management and construction, the little things that people probably never think of consciously, but when they walk in and they see our furniture is arranged properly and it's coordinated right, and we've got our logo on our signs, and it really feels like it's a complete product.
The final award winners of the 2013 Urban Land Institute Global Award for Excellence are expected to be announced soon. Jeremy's design team, though, is staying busy. Another apartment complex in Fayetteville, the Cardinal at West Center, is having a grand opening today and is registered for LEED Green Building Certification. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Callums. In just a few minutes, Antoinette Grajeda will take us on that boat ride on a man-made lake near Elkins. But first, a few notes.
The KUAF website giveaway is offering a pair of season tickets to the 2013 Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Art Series. One winner will receive a pair of tickets to each of the 10 shows. Performances include Onda Union, Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, Chucho Valdez, and more. The drawing will be held tomorrow during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at our website, KUAF.com.
If you have Alzheimer's disease or think you may have Alzheimer's disease, Health Initiatives Research is seeking participants to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an oral study drug that may slow the progression of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. More information is available at 871-1771.
Northwest Arkansas Community College will host one of five statewide Freedom of Information Act roadshows this fall in conjunction with the Arkansas Attorney General's Office. The roadshow at the college is 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. tomorrow in the Walmart Auditorium at the Shoemaker Center for Workforce Technologies in Bentonville. The workshops are designed to provide public assistance to public officials who handle Freedom of Information Act matters, as well as to any Arkansan who wishes to learn more about the law. Attorney General's FOIA roadshows are free and open to the public. Registration is required. To register, email info@arkansaspress.org or call 501-374-1500.
The fourth annual Eureka Palooza Outdoor Festival is Saturday at Lake Leatherwood. It goes from 11 until 11. Music, food, bouncy castles, games, a beer garden, vendors, and more included. The family-friendly festival features two stages with musical entertainment. There will be also a showcase of talented young musicians from around the area. The professional lineup includes Sarah and the Meanies, National Park Radio, who are on the radio with us
tomorrow.
Stiff Neck Fools, Dime Trip, and several others. The idea for the showcase of the young musicians comes from the popularity of some of their performances last year by high school students from Clear Spring School and the Benton County School of the Arts. The outstanding performers were selected after a public audition in Basin Springs Park last month. Eureka Palooza will be Saturday from 11 to 11 at Lake Leatherwood Fields.
The Army Corps of Engineers is calling for volunteers to help clean up Beaver Lake during their annual Beaver Lake cleanup. Volunteers should check in by 8 a.m. this Saturday at the following state parks: Prairie Creek, Hickory Creek, Rocky Branch, Lost Bridge North, or Dam Site. Trash bags will be furnished to all participants at each check-in station, but please bring your own gloves. The cleanup will take place from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. A lunch of hot dogs and soft drinks will be served from 11 a.m. until 1.
After that's for the first 500 volunteers, right? By the way.
That's a lot of volunteers.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's a big lake.
Yeah. Volunteers who have access to a boat are encouraged to bring it to transport their families and friends or to help with transportation of other volunteers who don't have boats. Participants who help transport other volunteers will receive a complimentary bag of giveaways.
And beginning Saturday, Smallen Cave near Springfield, Missouri, is inviting visitors to experience local history. Each Saturday, beginning this weekend through the first week of November, the cave site will host a dinner consisting of beans, cornbread, and fried potatoes. There will also be storytelling by lantern light and a lantern-lit walk into the cave. Reservations do have to be made in advance. Tickets are $29.95 for the entire evening. No tickets available for children under the age of 8. For more information, smallincave@centurylink.net. That's S-M-A-L-L-I-N, cave, Smallen Cave.
Last month in our monthly sports series, we took a look at the various activities offered at the University of Arkansas. We missed, however, the Water Ski Club team. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda caught up with them for this month's sports installment.
Somebody jump out and do those.
You got them. I got this next set.
I think those ones are pretty good.
During one of the last warm days of the summer season, members of the University of Arkansas's water ski club team jump off a red and white ski boat into a man-made lake located just south of Elkins. Every so often, club president Tom Gieslin stops the boat at various points along the middle of the narrow lake to allow his three teammates to jump overboard.
They're lowering the buoys. See, the ones in the middle, the yellows, those are boat guides. And the ones on the outside that are reddish orange, they're the buoys that we slalom ski around. And we like to have them at a relatively low spot so that way we can ski around them easy and then I don't hit them as often with the boat.
The private lake is part of the Cedar Creek Water Ski Park. Roger and Karen Boskis began construction on the park in the winter of 2000. The pair of lakes at the park are specifically designed for three water skiing events, slalom, trick, and jump. According to the park's website, the East Lake is 12 feet deep and 300 feet wide. The West Lake, where the U of A Water Ski Club practices twice a week, has a depth of approximately 6 feet, which minimizes wake caused by the boat, but is deep enough for slalom turns. Club president Tom Gieslin says the team has 14 members this semester, and their season usually lasts from August to mid-October. Tom is serving his first semester as club president, and the senior architect major is fairly new to the sport.
One of my friends, right after I graduated high school, took me out wakeboarding with his brother-in-law, and I had a ton of fun out on the lake and wakeboarding and stuff, and I was decent at it for it being my first time, and then another friend of mine took me out water skiing, and I did the one ski thing, which is the slalom ski, and I like that a lot too. Found out the university had a team when I was handed a flyer for it, and joined the team.
This semester, there are a number of skiers, such as freshman Mackenzie Bramwell, who are new to the team, as well as to this form of skiing.
Well, I've been skiing before, but like on open lakes. At Beaver, we ski. Me and my family do a lot. And so coming to a course, it's so different. There's so many rules and just procedures that just you have to do them. Why? It's just very specific. It's difficult.
Some of her teammates have similar stories. Freshman Tyler Trotman and senior Michael Thurman, who grew up skiing on Grand Lake and Greers Ferry Lake, respectively, say there are several differences skiing at a water ski park instead of on an open lake.
Yeah, it's a lot easier on a small lake because, I mean, like you said, there's no waves from other people. It's all your own. And keeping your hips up and your chest up instead of having to adjust for wake from other people.
On lakes, you ski with your knees bent, and you ride like a shock absorber because you're steady bumping, bump, 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 bump. Yeah. But here you can stand up and lay into it because you're not having to fight the waves. Okay. It's not beating you to death.
Yeah.
Because if you try to ski straight up on a regular lake, you'll end up
you'll
end up crashing
over.
Stu Dernley, a creative writing graduate student, has experience snow skiing. So did those skills help him transition to the water?
No, it's the exact opposite. In snow skiing, you want to have your weight forward, and here you've got to have your weight back. So, but it's also you've got one ski instead of two. So it's not like you're sitting there trying to apply snow skills to the water.
Throughout practice, the athletes take turns using dish soap to help slide their foot into the boot of a single ski. Senior Michael Thurman explains there are different skis for men and women, and it's basically based on weight. For example, a shorter ski is set up for a lighter weight athlete. Club president Tom Gieslin says in the past, the team has participated in 3 to 4 competitions during a season. They typically participate against other teams in the National Collegiate Water Ski Association's South Central region. The teammates coach each other, and during this particular practice, senior Chris Wendell is providing lots of advice. He says right now, they only have a few team members who can run the entire slalom course, so they are currently in a learning period.
To start out, we're just trying to get people used to going across the wake and cutting across the wake while you're on edge. Which is on edge, you want to be on the side of the ski so that you cut through the wake and you don't So you're not bouncing through the wake. And so right now, that's really our focus to get people used to doing that, so that you can eventually get out to the buoy to be able to go around it.
Although the team is comprised of several novices to this form of skiing, athletes like freshman Tyler Trotman are enjoying the challenge.
It's new and it's different, but it's a lot of fun and it's a good learning activity. So I enjoy it a lot. I like the critiques and advice all the upperclassmen have for me.
Equipment and uniforms are provided for team members, and dues are $150 per semester. More information about the University of Arkansas's Water Ski Club team is available at urec.uark.edu. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ready? Mackenzie, what speed? 26? Yeah. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Here we go.
It is Thursday, September 26, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Last Thursday of September, Becca Martin-Brown, what do you got for us?
Something completely different.
All right.
Completely different. No bikes.
No blues.
No blues, no barbecue, no metal bands. We have Cinderella.
Ah. That's quite a bit tamer.
Isn't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of just sigh and say Cinderella. Now, it is not the Disney version of Cinderella.
It's all right.
It is a story adapted by William Glennon, and it stays true to the original plot, of course, but it's just a little bit different, and it will be on stage this weekend at the Art Center of the Ozarks. It's the first of their Child's Play series for the fall. The director, Danny Hobson, says the characters add a lot of humor to the show. The stepmother and stepsisters create lots of hilarity, and there's also the jester who befriends Cinderella and shows her that even in the worst of circumstances, there's always something to smile about.
The jester is always my favorite.
Anytime there's a jester, you like the jester. Okay. And the lessons, he says, are good triumphing over evil and treating people the way you want to be treated, and always be nice and never seek revenge.
Good
points.
Good lessons, yeah.
3 o'clock tomorrow, or rather Saturday and Sunday at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. Tickets start at $8 for member students, and you can call 751-5441.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, we preview the 2013 King Biscuit Blues Festival that happens in Helena, Arkansas, October 10th through the 12th. Headliners, Marsha Ball, Robert Cray, Greg Allman, and more. That's the Generic Blues Show right here on KOAF every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
The Eureka Springs Original Ozark Folk Festival presents a live recording of Michael Jonathan's Wood Songs Old Time Radio Hour, Saturday, October 26th in the City Auditorium. Guests include recording artist Michael Martin Murphy and the local winner of the Wood Songs Talent Search. A limited number of tickets are available online at theaud.org. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
And support for KUAF comes from Clark Partners Realty Group. Offering a variety of floor plan options at condos at the Peaks just off I-540 in Rogers, 935-6080, or condosatthepeaks.com for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, London.
London. Arkansas.
Yeah, well, sure, yes, of course. Down by Russellville and Dardanelle, our colleague Antoinette Grajeda traversing around that part of the world today. Going to have some stories from that part of the area that you'll hear in the future.
Right. We could have listeners in London, England, though. KUAF.com.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also coming up soon, a story from Huntsville that Jacqueline Froelich did. She talked to another person who's reached 100 years of age and still very active. That's coming up as well.
All right. And you'll be back tomorrow?
I will, with Antoinette.
Okay.
And you and I back Sunday morning at 9 a.m. for Weekend Ozarks at Large.
I should say Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Thursday.